This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
I am about to attempt something ridiculous, perhaps absurd, even ludicrous. I am going to try and describe the look, and I hope suggest some of the meanings, of a century-old style of avant-garde art making, and I am going to do it on the radio. The odds of failure are very high, of course, maybe even off the charts. My one hope in attempting it is that the style is so shaped by practices that seemed in their time, a century ago, to be themselves absurd, ludicrous, even ridiculous, and were relished by the artists who made the pictures for being so, that my own low absurdity may meet their higher absurdity and make something of it. The style I'm speaking of is the one we call Cubism, and it was made above all by two men, the Frenchman Georges Braque and the Spaniard Pablo Picasso, in Paris and various resorts in Spain and the south of France just a century ago. It first emerged around 1908 under the influence of the late paintings of Paul Cézanne and came to its height and its head in the summer of 1913, when the colored, decorative, graphic style that art historians call synthetic cubism began to replace the brown, muddled, chiaroscuro style that they call analytic cubism. That's quite an art historical mouthful, and I crush it into a single sentence because I want to get past that stuff as quickly as we can. Neither of those names, analytic or synthetic cubism, really means much. But they do point to a break in the style, and a decisive one. And by pointing to a decisive break in a style that was at that time only about 4 years old to begin with, they remind us of a truth about cubism easily overlooked. It arose at a time of immense cultural acceleration. Most of the time, if you think about it, culture creeps forwards by decades, as adults do. At rare moments, it races by in months and years, like an adolescent. Anyone who came of age in the 1960s and lived for its music will recall, for instance, how the hooded-eyed, electric Bob Dylan of 1969 was a completely different creature from that sincere civil rights ruffian with an acoustic guitar of just 5 years before. Though when we talk about cubism, very much a collaboration of opposites, Picasso and Braque, we are closer to Lennon and McCartney, with Picasso the tough-edged anti-sentimentalist and Braque the more delicate melodist of form. Well, I see that I am doing what every critic does when we approach cubism, and that is to talk around the subject rather than through or really about it. I promised to describe as much as analyze, and now I shall, or try to, anyway. The 1913 picture I'll talk about is one that lives at the Tate in London, one of the rare classic cubist pictures that made its way across the Channel, despite a largely suspicious reception in Britain. It's a collage involving cut paper elements, and it's called Bottle of Vieux-Marc, Glass Guitar, and Newspaper. Vieux-Marc is a kind of French brandy made from already pressed grapes. What do we see when we look at it? Well, first of all, and rather surprisingly, we see the masthead of Le Figaro, a paper still published in Paris. The actual thing, real newspaper, a little, though only a little, browned by time and pasted directly onto the picture's surface. Yet that newspaper sits within a flat, rendered world, which indicates, rather than really fully realizing objects, a bottle, a glass, and a guitar, we sense at once, I think, clear feeling of a mundane totality. We're at a cafe table, and there's a guitar somewhere in the vicinity. Still, all of that, that little world, has been stenographically suggested by the most parsimonious of signs. What we're looking at is not suggested impressionistically, but rendered diagrammatically. We see this world through a faceted prismatic glass brightly. We're in a world of signs, distilled down from appearances to their conceptual essence. The guitar placed in the center of this picture is far from fully realized, but it's not a sketch of a guitar, really. More, one might say, a list of one, rendered as a catalog of familiar elements. A guitar, this picture gaily proposes, is a sounding hole and a womanly edge and a fretboard of parallel lines. And if you get these things right, in whatever jaunty order you put them down, you have got your guitar. That kind of conceptual rendering, as it's sometimes called, is very familiar. I used to play a children's parlor game where you had three simple geometric objects and you had to dress them up with an erasable crayon to spell out a famous scene or a text. Three quickly drawn mustaches and you had the whole of a Dumas novel. That's the kind of representation that's going on here. Suave, rapid fire, economical, and wittily minimal. At the same time, the more we look, the more I think we see that the picture isn't entirely like that. Some of the things we see, like the rendering of the glass on the right, are illusions suggesting the actual play of light on objects. Other things, like that Figaro headline, are the real things as they exist in the world, imported whole to the middle of this, in many ways, mysterious picture. Now, what would we really think, I wonder, if we were truly amateur lookers in 1913, uncorrupted by art history? Would the picture baffle us? Well, many people were baffled by it and its brothers and sisters then. But what's really interesting is that most of that 1913 audience, at least to judge by the popular cartoons and cabaret sketches that Cubism provoked, thought, first and above all, that Cubism was fun. This kind of picture, most people seem to think, you had to see as a kind of rebus, a riddle, one of those play pictures that asks you to figure out from all its parts what its message is. A word here, half a smile over there, a guitar part over here. It's a puzzle meant to be enjoyed as one. Now, the pictures, in truth, were never neatly programmatic, simply solved. But we do get much closer to the spirit in which Cubism was made, I think, if we treat them as a joke in that sense, as riddles and rebuses, than if we think of them as profound philosophical reflections on the nature of space and time. I say that because many commentators have insisted, over the past century, that Cubism's view of reality is somehow in tune with the new and, indeed, exactly contemporary physics of Albert Einstein, where time and space are also entangled together. Now, this may be true in some way, but it is one of those truths that exist in the hazy cloud cover of the zeitgeist more than in the particular granular world of actual intention. Cubism, I think, is both metaphysics and mischief. Those are the things that are entangled together. Both count, but the mischief is, I think, closest to Cubism's heart. Cubism is a kind of decorum-destroying game. It sends up, rather than blows up, the conventions of illusion it inherited, in the same way that, say, Gilbert and Sullivan send up the conventions of opera, while still paying a kind of smiling homage to them. It's not, I think, as is sometimes said, that Picasso and Braque bravely rejected the perceptual representation that was the legacy of the Renaissance, those systems of modeling and of linear perspective that had for so long conquered the representation of the visible world. Because the truth is that there is perspective here, and an odd and quite beautiful enigmatic play of light and shadow as they strike objects in the world. But the neat registry of shapes as they exist in the mind is registered too. We see this picture with the part of the mind where objects exist alongside words and tunes and newspaper headlines. Now, in the painting of the Impressionists, it's certainly the case that our eyes already flicker from shape to pattern and do it restlessly. Part of the joy of a great Monet is to approach the picture and see all the discrete, minute touches of independent color that combine as we step back and see a lily pond shimmering at dawn. But these delights, though far from superficial, are still optical. Cubism is the first self-consciously cognitive style. Every time we look at it, it reminds us that we see with our minds. Now, Picasso and Braque never articulated that as a specific plan. They had no plan, no manifesto, and they resisted, indeed hated, any explanation of their purpose. It's no accident, I think, that first among all their contemporary heroes were not any philosopher or scientist. No, their real heroes were the Wright brothers, who in those years had made the first heavier-than-air flying machine and brought it triumphantly to France. Picasso and Braque even like to call each other Orville and Wilbur, and their collages and paintings are filled with references to flight. "Our future is in the air," one famous clipped headline reads in another picture. And what fascinated Picasso and Braque about the Wright brothers was that they had just made their airplane up non-systematically, changing this wing shape and changing that positioning. And suddenly, man flew. Man flew when he tinkered. And pictures of the kind they were making escaped the old gravitational pull of Renaissance-born illusion, not when they kicked and complained, but when they punned and they played. Well, so what? Why does that matter in the way so much else of the art and literature of 1913 so obviously does? Part of the answer is indeed art historical and lies in what happened next in modern art. Cubism was as potent to visual culture as Einstein's equations were to physics. Picasso and Braque, like Orville and Wilbur Wright, their heroes, made something useful. Cubism, a language without an ideology, appeared at a moment when many artists in Europe had an ideology in need of a language, and Cubist style became the common tongue of the European avant-garde. So much that would happen in modern art is deducible from this modest-looking collage. The abstract art of Mondrian is prophesized in the dissolution of objects into geometry. The more mischievous painterly elements of Dada are there in the intrusion of a principle of chance, the principle that puts the guitar hole here and its neck over there. Futurism in Italy took from Cubist syncopations a surging pictorial dynamism. Even Art Deco design of the kind I see around every day in New York, with its geometric frills and broken rhythms, begins here. And so certainly does the pop art that rose 50 years later, with its love of erasing the line between the uncelebrated actual object, like the newspaper headline, and the solemn actions of serious art. But there is, I think, a deeper and more broadly humane reason that Cubism still resonates. I may lose whatever credit I have left with art historians if I say this, but I think that it is true. Cubism touches us because it is, above all, a happy style, and it partakes of the joy of one of the last persuasively optimistic moments in modern history. This not-so-still still life suggests an entirely positive view of modern urban culture, of modern energy, and even of the supposedly leveling force of modernity, where you read Le Figaro and work on avant-garde art as part of one morning's experience. A small daily paradise made of the most ephemeral bits and pieces of our daily life. It encourages us to live and to see in our daily life the possibility of a humming redemption of the ordinary. Was 1913 the last happy European year? Our future, all too horribly, was in the air of armed combat, and eventually of the bomber and fighter. So perhaps it is not nostalgia, but real communication across a century that makes us relax and smile when we see this collage exactly a century later. When we look at it, we see a small world. Coffee is made, the studio gossip is over, and the morning papers, seen and cut at a glance, perhaps hint at news of distant Balkan wars, but for the moment they're worth only a shrug and a quick movement of the scissors to cut them out. The deadpan joke, the visual pun, the play of the mind in the morning seems like very slight and ludicrous and, yes, absurd, even ridiculous, ammunition to aim against the monsters of modern madness. Yet what other ammunition do we have? We look at this collage and think, well, that little morning battle of making was won. And the Great War that will erase so many mornings in the following year still seems far away. The cataract of rushing modern time that provided energy for Picasso's own work seems to halt for once at the edge of the abyss. Living in time, the Cubist picture stops it.